5.5 million acres of public land extend inland to the glaciers from the coast of Prince William Sound and the Copper River Delta. It's a research area, a playground, and educational resource. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The Chugach National Forest and University of Alaska Anchorage are putting on the Classrooms for Climate Symposium. Organizers and the keynote speaker are here for you to talk with at 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at aprn.org. Learning in the Chugach on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
The University of Alaska Anchorage and the Forest Service have put together this conference that actually is starting now with a kind of a youth component, but goes on through the week, and it's called Classrooms for Climate. And they brought in an illustrious and MacArthur Foundation recipient here as a keynote speaker, and she's sitting across from me. Majora Carter, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you for having me.
And you also do a public radio talk show, and there are probably some people listening right now who know you just from this show. So why don't you explain that show, The Promised Land?
Sure. Yeah, the name of the show is called The Promised Land, and it is a show about visionaries working to transform their own communities in innovative ways. So we've spoken to folks, you know, like Winona LaDuke, you know, who's been working for energy and food sovereignty, or to, I mean, that just spent time visiting the Gulf Coast, speaking to people about what's life been for them after the BP oil spill.
And you are also, I think, known for your work in the South Bronx. And essentially what happened there is many people call it transformation. And I guess it kind of all started with you realizing that there actually was one spot that you could actually get to the water from your neighborhood. And that has now kind of blossomed.
Yes.
Can you explain what it's like there now?
Sure. Let me just go back a little bit before, because you know, my community was probably more well known before this for the fact that it was both environmentally and economically severely disadvantaged.
Well, it's not anymore?
No, we still are to some extent, but not like we used to be by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, you know, my community was literally the poster child for urban blight in the 70s and 80s. We lost about 60% of our population, literally, because highway construction and also literally being built through our communities, but also landlords were torching their own buildings in order to collect insurance money because there was no financial investment coming in at all. So, you know, I lived in a place that really did look like a war zone and kind of felt like one in many cases. And the manufacturing that used to be there kind of went away, and waste facilities came and took their place, and we developed, we handled about 40% of the city's commercial waste for a while, and then we were going to get even more. And so transforming the just the perception of our community as a place where you only dumped on and turned it into something that was about creating a more holistic and healthy environment for the people that live there was that, just that act itself, like literally staking that claim, was a really amazing, almost act of defiance in a lot of ways.
So
one of the things that I did was actually start a environmental and economic solutions organization, because here we were, poster child for urban blight. You know, there were lots of environmental burdens, really poor people, mostly of color. And what I wanted to do was create the kind of projects, and we were very project-based, that had both poverty alleviation as well as environmental restoration at their core. So I worked to transform a dump into a park. It had been used for decades as part of an illegal dump for a really long time by the construction industries in particular. And then later on, I started one of the country's very first green collar job training and placement systems, where we train people in the field of ecological restoration. So green roofing, urban forestry management, wetland restoration, learning how to clean up contaminated lands for active reuse, and training people who were generationally impoverished or going in and out of prison, you know, folks that had been told that they would never amount to anything, but again, it gave them both a personal and a financial stake in improving the environment as they got a job to help them improve their own lives.
It sounds like one hell of a lot of work.
Yes, it was. But it was incredibly, to see people's lives change as they saw themselves as incredibly powerful agents of change, and to know that they could do something to support their own communities and support their own families, that was an incredibly beautiful place to be in. And I, you know, ran Sustainable South Bronx, was the name of my agency, for 7 years. And I will never forget looking at people's faces and knowing when the light would click on in their head, when they realized, you know what, I do matter and I could help. And it was really powerful. And all I want to do is help make that happen all over the country and all over the world.
Which you're not exactly a greenie. I mean, you talk about the green the green collar, but, you know, just to pursue this a little bit more.
I know.
You're not really an environmentalist. But you want economic development. You want jobs.
That is, I think, the nature of what environmentalism actually should be. We really do. You can't separate the environment from the economy any more than you can separate the economy from the environment. And when the second you start doing that, that's when you get into the problems that we have. And what I wanted to do, and what a lot of folks, unfortunately, I'm not the only one, you know, who thinks that you can actually have a much cleaner and greener environment, one that actually does not depend on the degradation of, in particular, poor people, because they're the ones, I mean, whether you're having, when you're dealing with the fossil fuel economy, where you're extracting, you know, that fuel, where you're refining it, where you're burning it, where that is actually happening is where the poorest people live. And they come in all different colors. And so it's not just a poor, you know, inner city kind of thing. I mean, it's happening in coal country. It's happening, you know, in places, you know, here, you know, and all around the country where there's these natural resources that are considered precious. But unfortunately, the people who live closest to the impacts are not the main beneficiaries, at least not like, you know, outside of it. So for me, it is just a part of being human and understanding that, you know, you do not have to rest an economy on the backs of poor people and make their lives more miserable, but instead we can come up with opportunities that really do support them.
I lived in the Robert Moses, New York.
Oh, really?
Yes. And it's interesting when you know, here's this man known for the massive public works projects,
right,
and highways and giant buildings, mm-hmm, and all this sort of thing. And you called it, I think, poor planning.
Yes, I did.
Poor planning. Essentially, they just carved your whole neighborhood up with these freeways, made it impossible to get to the water,
yeah,
and so forth.
It was, I mean, if you look at maps of the Bronx, which is where I'm from, you know, prior to the 1940s, I mean, there were boulevards, there were neighborhoods, there were these whole communities. You know, most of them were not filthy rich by any stretch of the imagination, but they were thriving, you know, working in middle class communities, and people could make a living, they could go shopping, they could build, you know, the life and be happy to hand it over to their child. And when the highways were built, it literally made the spaghetti network of highways throughout my community. And people were often given less than a month's notice before they were told they had to leave the lives that they built. And of course that had an impact. It cut communities off from itself. It cut them away from their waterfront. It cut, you know, whole economic engines literally out of the fabric of our borough.
What is so fascinating about it is you go ahead and call it poor planning, which really then leads to what's good planning.
Right.
And that seems to be really a lot of what you're about. But I want to get to the other guests before we pursue that. So we are speaking with Majora Carter. She is a developer of climate adaptation, urban micro ag business, and leadership development strategies. And she's the keynote speaker at the Classrooms for Climate conference. She'll be giving a public keynote speech on tomorrow night at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Now, from the Forest Service, Sarah Borio of the Chugach National Forest is in the Public Affairs and Partnerships Office. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning.
Good morning. So you have this conference going on.
Yes.
And it's been, I guess, some time in the works.
Yes, we've been working with the University of Alaska Anchorage for about the last 9 to 10 months on planning this. And really there are about three purposes for this symposium. Is one was just to simply survey the state of climate-related knowledge around the Chugach and the surrounding landscapes. You know, we know this is the most northern forest in the nation, and there's a tremendous amount of research and work going on by different agencies, the USGS, by universities actually from around the world, but we didn't really have our arms around all of it. So this was really our first attempt at bringing all these people together in the same room, and there's going to be about 100 presenters coming to talk about glaciology to public health, you know, subsistence, a number of issues to share, kind of like get our hands around this issue. And the second really important thing was to really cement our relationship with the university. You know, the University of Alaska Anchorage and the Chugach kind of have remarkably similar geographic footprint. We share really similar boundaries, and, you know, the students and professors from the university really consider this landscape a natural campus. So how could we really begin to look at ways that we could partner around issues of climate, around education and economic opportunities for students? And the third thing was to really create an opportunity for youth and public engagement. And you previously mentioned the Youth Eco Forum that is put on by a sister event that we've partnered with the Northern Forum to bring kids from around the circumpolar north.
You've got Russian kids here.
We have Russian kids, we have Chinese kids, we have kids from the Yukon Territory. And then also so to bring the kids, but also to find a way that we could really get into the community here and make it kind of accessible and start a larger conversation. And that's when we really thought of Majora, because she really, through her work with Sustainable South Bronx, her economic consulting firm, her radio show, The Promised Land, really sharing stories of people taking positive action in their community, in their backyard, and recognizing that those backyards are often a stair step to the larger public landscapes further out, and how that immediate action access can create a lifelong bond with the outdoors and really a sense of empowerment for themselves.
I think it's very odd to think of this notion of taking control of your community, working towards sustainability. I mean, a lot of people are very interested in that. We've been dipping into that as a subject area on Talk of Alaska statewide for about 5-6 years now. It started with energy, and now it's moved to food. You know, people are very concerned about food security, and they want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. People are very, very worried because it costs so much to do anything in rural Alaska because the price of fuel is so high, and they want to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So the result now we're getting, windmills are popping up. There's all sorts of, you know, attempts, movements, but we don't think about public lands in this regard. It seems to me that when it comes to public lands, we think of, oh, that's federal. That's off. They won't let us do anything in there. I'm sensing there's a certain change of the guard in public lands a little bit to a more partnership attitude towards the local jurisdictions. I guess it's only, when I look back on it, to the history of the Forest Service in the Agriculture Department, maybe that actually makes sense that agency is doing that. So we're joined with by Dave Cleaves. He is you are the climate change advisor for the U.S. Forest Service. I have a hunch, Dave, that they just made up your job.
I made up my job.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not advisor to all 33,000 employees. You know, I can't get away with that. Mainly, I advise the chief and the executive team on how to integrate climate change into everything we do. And part of what we do is manage the public lands, at least the National Forest System, 193 million acres. And then we have state and private programs that assist private owners and urban areas and others. And so it's been a fascinating little journey. I've been in this job about a year and a half now. And what's interesting, the reason I was so anxious to be here was to connect with what's going on the ground. In Alaska, it's kind of a bellwether for adapting to climate change because the temperature has gone up here about twice the rate it has in the lower 48 states. And some of the issues that you're dealing with here, the rural-urban issues that you mentioned, the issue of the relationship of public lands to the citizens, the energy cost, all that is more serious here than it is elsewhere.
Let me tell you another one we saw almost 30 years ago now, which was that the spruce bark beetle came in and
yes.
wiped out a whole lot of our spruce.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and there had been these things in the past, but not to the scale that it happened this time. It's actually still going on. It's on up into Canada and down into Southeast now. And it looks like that's just the beginning of some really drastic changes for our forest in Alaska. I'm talking the boreal forest, you know, mostly outside of Chugach, which is, according to one expert, Glenn Judé, under such stress that he's not sure many of those trees are going to survive. There's only going to be some trees will survive. Yeah. He thinks whole forests are under great threat of extinction because the pattern of the weather has changed and they can't endure the stress.
Well, and I think your use of the word stress, I think, is a good one, because that's really what we're into, is how do we act as stress managers for the forest, and whether it's beetles or whether it's the drying out of the interior Alaska and the fire problems, there all of these elements of stress are tied in one way or another to climate change, not just climate change, but it's certainly influenced by climate change. So we have the climate that's kind of revving things up and connecting them more. And so how do we act as better stress managers? But it's not just about the forest. It's about the people and the forest. And I think that what we're seeing here, the impacts of these impacts are going to be felt in terms of people's lives. And what Majora was outlining here was a very cogent point, is that the people who are already stressed themselves, populations and communities that are already stressed themselves, under the influence of climate change, is going to even be worse if they can't get up on top of it, if they can't turn that negative into a positive, into an opportunity. And we can develop all the government programs that you can shake a stick at or a deficit at, and it really doesn't matter unless you've got that missing ingredient, which is ingredients, which are innovation and vision, enthusiasm. So, you know, the kind of programs that Majora is leading and that we have going in the partnerships here provide that missing catalyst, that catalyst that make these other things go. So what I'm interested in doing here is learning more about, you know, what that mix is, so that I can go back to our executive team meetings and say, you know, I didn't spend the last week in Washington here, ha ha ha. You know, I actually was on the ground and I talked to some folks who were doing some things, and this is how things kind of play out, and maybe we can build a little more realism into the huff and puff discussions that we have in Washington, maybe get something a little bit better headed your way.
There's one more buzzword I want to throw into all that, mm-hmm. and it is resilience. And I think it's one that I see all three of you nodding your heads. But you know, there was a time when it was thought, if we talk about adaptation, we're basically not addressing mitigation. If we talk about adaptation, it just means we're going to not do anything about climate change. We're just going to adapt to it. We need to look to we're adapting it. And there's still a lot of that kind of talk. But the fact of the matter is, no matter what happens with carbon dioxide, with black carbon, we're going to have to adapt. Mm-hmm. And what we need to look towards is resilience. It would appear that local control and resilience have a lot to do with one another, wouldn't you say?
I would absolutely say. And also that, you know, it's not an either or. It's an and when, if you ask me. And yeah, I see you nodding too. So good. Right. Glad you think so as well.
Exactly right.
But I also think that, you know, and I think part of the way that much of the climate language has been put out there for a while, it is so much about doom and gloom. It's like, you know, we're going to drown, we're going to burn everything. It's just everything is just going to be so horrible. And not to say that, you know, these things aren't going to, you know, impact us in a very, very serious way. But I think that there actually is a somewhat brighter side to it. It also, because we are resilient as a people and as Americans, we can figure our way out of this in a way that actually supports people on the ground. And in particular, the way that I'm looking at this is around how do you develop environmental design with accessible jobs to help us deal with our climate as it is changing, to help us adapt to it. You know, like we know, you know, what has happened, you know, with the fossil fuel economy. However, if we're thinking about how do we make our cities and our rural areas more resilient by using green infrastructure to, you know, help absorb stormwater, to help keep the air cleaner, to lower the ambient temperature of surrounding cities with vegetation so that you can actually reduce the amount of energy that you use, that's green roofing, that's wetland restoration, that is urban forestry managed, that's restoring, you know, old farmlands or places that used to be farmlands into forests again. Though all of those things, you have a real value and they provide environmental services as well. So And especially if you're, you know, getting accessible jobs to people who are, you know, have been traditionally left out, you know, if there was timber, if there was manufacturing in these places, and guess what, there isn't anymore because the economy has changed. How about we start creating more accessible jobs and green infrastructure and making sure we're getting work to people who actually need it to provide a service that we need?
I'll tell you another source of potential energy that's vastly untapped in Alaska, and that is tradition. Knowledge that people have, and you certainly see it in your own home city, that people brought in their folkways and knowing how to do things, and then found that they didn't have the wherewithal to do the things that they knew how to do and to teach their young how to do. And as we respect our tradition bearers a little bit more, I think we have, just as you have when a person feels they're worthless and then they discover they actually can do something, you get like this, this sort of extra effect. Same deal. There's a lot of power in this knowledge that the elders have that they're just dying to share, and yet where's the receptive audience? Mm. Let's turn back to the educational side of it. We don't have anybody from UAA here. I think it's kind of too bad in a way. But they're changing the guard. I guess Fran Ulmer was the one that pretty well set this up, and now she's moving on to polar research. It was going to be very interesting, Arctic research. She came into the university from the Institute for Social and Economic Research. So Fran would be an interesting guest, but she's not here. But Sarah, there has been an effort to integrate a whole lot of different parts of the university. Public health, I notice, and all the hard science kind of people that are out in the glaciers and whatnot, and ICER that we talked about, where Fran used to be. You know who I don't see is the civil engineers.
Good point.
Serious. We heard Majora talk about design.
Yep.
And the fact that that's what they do, civil engineers.
We actually did. We did have some exchange with that community and recruiting for an agenda item around that issue, and it didn't materialize in time.
It's a small department.
Yes. But the education piece we have. We really have. We've reached out and engaged the education department at the University of Alaska Anchorage and a number of the nonprofit world here in Anchorage that's working with youth around environmental education and frankly, climate adaptation and employment opportunities from Alaska Geographic, Alaska Youth to Environmental Action, Anchorage Park Foundation. Later today, actually, we're going to go, Majora's going to address a local group of people engaging youth in green jobs opportunities from the Youth Employment and Parks Program to Cook Inlet Tribal's Youth Build, Alaska Works. And it really is getting at those opportunities of supporting our local partners, empowering our local partners, and creating jobs out of that in the environment. You know, a really perfect example is through the Forest Service, through state and private forestry. We invest in the Urban Forestry Program here in Anchorage, and that money in part helps support the Youth Employment and Parks teams that remove the beetle kill up in far north Bicentennial Park. And so that's the way that we really are partnering in the local community around that component.
Right. Chugach is involved with the ANSEP, too?
Yeah, we're involved with ANSEP, too, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program here at the University of Alaska Anchorage. It's a really groundbreaking program that is helping us bring Alaska Native students into our workforce in both engineering and the biological sciences. And last year, we had two or three students on the Chugach, and I think we'll have another couple this year as well.
Wow. Well, so we've covered a whole lot of different ground, and I want to put it out to the listeners to pick it up wherever they would like. Our telephone number statewide is 1-800-478-8255. Majora Carter is with us, and you may recognize her voice from the public radio program The Promised Land, which won a Peabody Award. She's here. If you'd like to just say hi to her, that would be great. If you just want to give her a ditto and say, we think you're doing great work, that would be great. Or if you want to be more critical, I think that would be just fine, too. In Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Email us talk@aprn.org. Actually, it would be better if you call up and throw some bombs at us. It makes for a better show. It's more radio. We have not only Majora, but Sarah Borio, who you just heard from Chugach National Forest, and Dave Cleaves, who is the advisor on climate change for the chief of the U.S. Forest Service in Washington, D.C. And he's here observing to some degree, but also has some pretty definite ideas about how national forests can be involved in adapting to climate change. And so that's kind of been our subject. It is interesting to think of this national forest going all the way up into the glaciers. Mm-hmm. And this forest was established by Teddy Roosevelt because he didn't want the Morgans and Guggenheims to have control of what seemed like the most industrial, the land with the most industrial development potential in Alaska, so he just turned it into a big old national forest. That's how it started. It really did. It didn't stop the Morgans and the Guggenheims. They ended up having the world's richest copper mine on up to what is now the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. And they built the incredible Copper River and Northwestern Railroad out of Cordova. And they had so much money to invest in that they would literally have to rebuild the trestles every year. The trestle would wash out. These big, high trestles would wash out in the springtime. And they'd just build them up again and put the rails back on them and run the trains and take the ore in and out. It was very, very rich copper ore. And it basically broke down in the 30s when they found some copper ore in South America that they could get out cheaper, and one day they just pulled out of that mine. In the meantime, it turned out that Teddy Roosevelt and his trust-busting were not on the wrong track and that whole idea of the progressive era, because what they ended up doing is building the Alaska Railroad, because they didn't want this to be a railroad. The railroad going into interior Alaska should not belong to corporations. It needed to be a public railroad, and so they built this railroad, which goes from Seward all up into Fairbanks to this day, and there's talk now of extending it deeper into the state of Alaska. Probably be a good idea because rail is a cheap way to move stuff, and the kind of things that they're developing so far, probably moving coal has been the biggest source of revenue for the railroad, and then it would be moving refined product because the airport here is an air cargo hub for a big part of Asia, and the planes are refueling there, and they bring a lot of that in by train from a refinery up in the Fairbanks area, and gravel. Yeah. They carry lots of gravel.
Well, what's interesting, you know, mentioning the history of the Chugach is that, you know, the level, the types of development that have occurred there have waxed and waned over the years, but despite that, what's very interesting is it's the least roaded national forest, I think, in our system. I think less than 99 miles of road, and still there
right.
still is such
99 miles.
Like, how big is the whole?
About 5.4 million acres.
Oh my!
And so it's really incredible when you think about the history of development there, and yet it's still the least roaded forest in our system. And what an incredible, in many ways, untouched landscape it is.
A lot of that is the Crow Creek road there.
Yes, that's right. You just go up to dinner.
We've got almost a half a million miles of road in the rest of the system. So this is, there's lots of roads everywhere else, but this is...
Wow.
That's really, really something.
Yeah, and so it really is this untouched landscape that really, I think, it's one of its niches is really going to be this monitoring. You know, really the science and the monitoring that takes place on this landscape is going to be really important because it is, they have so many intact ecosystems.
Yeah. Well, Dennis from Clam Gulch joins us. Dennis, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve.
Hey, Dennis, how you doing?
Oh, any better? I don't know if I could stand it.
Wow, let's go up and
What's
visit
that?
Dennis.
Any good low tides lately out there?
Oh, life in paradise. Yeah, it's getting there. Looks like there's going to be some low tides that we're going to get to go down and wallow in the mud again this year.
Well, good, man. I'm telling you, I hate cleaning razor clams, but I love eating them.
Yeah, I hear you there. I don't like digging them so much, and neither do my knees.
Yeah, right. It's also cold. It's always cold when the best clamming is.
Sure, the wind's got to blow.
Yeah. Okay, Dennis, well, welcome to the show. What do you got to say?
Well, I guess I got a question for the folks, and it kind of goes back a few years. I was active on the Cook Inlet Region Citizens Advisory Council Environmental Monitoring Committee, and as a part of that process, I became aware of activities of other people, groups, agencies, and like that, and I was aware at that time of a, initially it was an effort just for Cook Inlet. It was called the Cook Inlet Information Monitoring, or Coconut Information System, SIMS, or something like that?
Yeah, it's a GIS project, yeah.
Well, it was not just GIS. It was overlapping data and information from, and it was expanded, I think, to include the whole state at one time. And
it was.
My question to your panel of folks gathered there is this, it was driven a lot by the Forest Service, by the way, Steve.
Hmm.
I'm
getting blank.
A lot of money came from there.
Dennis, I'm getting blank looks here. I don't think we have the right people here. You want to chime in here, Dave? You talk about GIS a bit.
Let me just jump in. Dennis, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're headed towards a really important point here, and that point is that, and I think Majora brings this up too, is that there is a place for the citizens themselves in monitoring. And monitoring, to me, is one of those elements of that new economy. Mm. So, and I don't know if that was part of this whole system, but when we dive into monitoring efforts, often they stumble because we don't have the hands on deck that we need, and we're not as coordinated as we could be across all the different entities that get into the monitoring that contribute to it, be they citizens, the Forest Service, USGS,
right.
and NOAA, you name it. And you got to put all those together into a monitoring program so that you can tell what you got.
Yeah, Cook Inlet Keeper has a pretty robust stream monitoring system. Is that what you were talking about, Dennis?
Well, actually, what I was getting at, and I think the call is going to be beneficial, possibly anyway, in this effort, is to question these folks if they're aware of the existence of this, if it still exists. It was designed to place this information across disciplines, across agencies, and for the public over the internet.
Okay, so Dennis, I'll tell you what I'll do. We're getting blank looks here, but I'm sure there's somebody in the brain bank listening to the show that knows exactly what you're talking about, and we certainly like to have them call. So Dennis.
Yeah, and Steve, just for fun, you've mentioned before when I communicated with you that hey, if you got any suggestions about future programs, this might be one.
Yeah, I agree.
Dennis, we're going to look this up. I'm sure it's just the function of being a big organization, and we'll find out what this is all about. But this idea of coordinated monitoring, it has to be better in the future. So
It's really an area that the university has, and maybe that is actually where it has been consolidated and housed, because they have the scenarios network action planning system now. They have a number of institutions that are really coordinating the data for all the agencies.
Dennis, I'll get back on that one. Yeah, thank you. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
Well, of course, anytime you talk about public land in Alaska, you're touching a nerve, because there is so much federal land in the state of Alaska, and there's always been considerable resentment in Alaskans feeling that if they were just left to their own devices, that they'd be better off if they could get their hands on those resources that are locked up in those federal lands. But we're seeing a little different picture today, and we're seeing a desire on the part of the Chugach National Forest, the Forest Service, and possibly other federal agencies really to more meaningfully engage with the local people. And it's because the climate is changing and we suddenly realize our public lands are a major resource. They're a monitoring resource, and there are a number of other things. I'm beginning to wonder, I have this picture that some years from now, agriculture in Alaska will be bigger than it is now. And as a matter of fact, I think it'll grow pretty tremendously in the next few years. It already is. There's a guy in Bethel that we've had on the show, Bethel, who who's exporting some food to Anchorage now. Nice organic food, good soil. And, you know, I'm just thinking we might actually, maybe some of this public land could end up in food production. Do you think that's a possibility, Dave Cleaves?
I think it's a possibility, and I think that our whole discussions about climate change are usually way, as Majora says, to the negative. We need to look on the opportunity side. And, you know, I think it was Joseph Priestley said that chance favors the prepared mind. Mm-hmm. So we may be having chances of changes. There's all kind of changes. But if somebody's prepared to jump on an opportunity, to turn that into a business opportunity, a sustainable one, that's great, and we should be supporting that just as much as we're worried about the risk side, the downside of all this. So I think you're right, and I think we're seeing these northward shifts of whole systems. And with those northward shifts, the growing conditions, the growing season, especially in Alaska, has increased. We're going to see these opportunities pop up all over the place, and the entrepreneurs, the visionaries, will jump on them.
Okay, we have a great venture capital outfit, Alaska Growth Capital. We've had them on the show. And essentially, they're one of the best venture capital outfits in the country because they have mm-hmm. a very low failure rate. And they've managed to get to the low failure rate by putting anybody that they give money to through a whole lot of training, which seems a very simple thing to do, right?
<I imagine>.
But, you know, the first thing you know when you try and start a business is you need to write a business plan. But then again, it has to be a real business plan. And how can you reinforce it and make it robust, and then how do you deal with where the marketplace for whatever your product is, where it's going to go? And some of these things you can actually see and predict. But for the most part, what we get when we open up the show to these kind of ideas and schemes is people say, okay, here it is. You know, I want to get on that volcano there, and I want to top out. I want to tap out the heat. I want to build greenhouses. I can feed all of the all of Cook Inlet here. All you got to do is give me the money to build my greenhouse. And it's always all you got to do is give me the money. I think we, you know, that's what excites me about having you on the show, Majora Carter, is that's what you're about. You're about investment.
But not on top of volcanoes.
Well, just on the edge of it.
Just the edge.
I'm not kidding about that one, by the way.
Well, there's something really beautiful about having a vision. Clearly, there is. But you're absolutely right. Your vision does have to be rooted, you know, with a certain degree of practicality, so you understand your market, you really understand the difference between profit and loss, and acceptable risk as well. So,
well,
volcanoes might be out.
Well, you talk about these walls, of the green walls.
Mm.
Tell me about that. I mean, that seems an awful risky thing.
Sure. Well, actually, back when I ran my nonprofit, Sustainable South Bronx, we really wanted to show that green, as you mentioned earlier, that like I'm not like your typical kind of environmentalist, and it's true.
And you said, yes, I am. I'm just a deeper kind.
But I don't fit the profile. I'm not male. I'm not white. You know,
start
I'm not
there. Yeah.
I'm pretty young, more or less. I think I'm young anyway. And and so much of this is about so we actually looked around and looked at different trends going forward, and also looked at what worked in other parts of the world. And green roofing, which was a sustainable building technique, had been used for more than 50 years in Western Europe. And you literally plant a roof, and you do it because it attracts between 75% to 90% of the stormwater that falls on it. So it doesn't have to be funneled through your very expensive sewage treatment, you know, process. It also cleans, since it's a green layer, it cleans the air. It makes
Well, how do you get, but how do you go back to the city and say, hey, look at here, we reduced your stormwater runoff by X percent, so now...
Interestingly enough, no, how we did it was we marketed it, you know, to individual folks, but then we also went to the city and said, you know what, we're actually reducing the more you allow this kind of building technique to happen in your city, the lower your stormwater management bills are going to be.
So you got them to ice break.
Yeah, we got them
regulatory
to
wise.
Literally, we got them to create a $4.50 per square foot tax break for folks who wanted to build a green roof on their own private residence.
So that starts being real hard money.
Exactly. And so we started a business actually before that happened, and then worked to create an alliance of 50 different, more than 50 different types of groups, from huge real estate developers down to little church groups who were interested in the idea that you could actually create stormwater management opportunities that created jobs, that improved air quality, that reduced stormwater management bills, all sorts of those things. And it really worked in a beautiful way.
So after your MacArthur and after you got done with the South Bronx, do you still live in the South Bronx?
I do.
Oh, but
across the street from the house I grew up in, actually.
You're in the business of selling solutions.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely.
You know, I mean, the way it was put down, and I think this is right off your webpage, climate adaptation, urban micro agro business, and leadership development.
Right. Exactly.
And then you talk about investable models. Don't you think we need a little bit different financial services system, some kind of approach to financing that's different than what we have right now? I mean, I spoke about the groundbreaking venture capital outfit we have in Alaska. It's wonderful. You know, I know the people that do it, and they're creative, interesting, wonderful people. For the most part, not here anymore. They're doing stuff in the third world now.
Mm.
But the idea is they figured out the model, and they moved the model. And, you know, I'm just wondering, it just seems that I'm picturing Dave Cuddy sitting behind his desk at the bank at First National. He does. He's retired out of First National, but it's still his family's bank, you know, and saying, I'm sorry, but you just don't seem to be a very good risk to me for financing this particular scheme. I mean, it seems like bank financing is not where entrepreneurs really are likely to.
Oh, I absolutely do believe that there is going to have to be a shift in terms of how we support these new type of enterprise. I mean, it's this. We're looking for things like patient capital, you know, and the type of investment that, you know, is looking for a return, but also seeing that there's a different kind of return, including financial, but also social and environmental. And, you know, but the model that we're pushing right now, it's a concept that's based that we're calling hometown security. It's about creating local economic models so that your dollars circulate throughout a local community. And we're very optimistic about the fact that there is going to be a whole new type of investor who's interested in not just doing charitable spending, but really creating sustainable solutions that support the local economy as well. So we're really excited about that.
The minute this thing starts actually taking off and getting big, the banks and the financial services industry are going to go after it. They're going to go to their friends in Washington. They're going to try and stop it.
You know, I can't really speak about that. All I know is that there are, folks out there who are looking at these models and seeing truly local economic development as something that's going to be supportive of our communities. And I'm really out there as much as I am talking about these things in the hope that we start, that those that have already drank that Kool-Aid, are really interested in bringing these type of models, to bear, and that we realize that we can't just, go to other countries, to support their development, but we need to be doing this right in our own hometowns, because often right away from some of the wealthiest areas, in our cities, there's some of the poorest ones, and those are the places that need that kind of investment as well. And also, when you do that, I mean, whether it's an urban micro agribusiness, that's what we are actually working on right now, or creating these new type of models for green infrastructure so that you're creating businesses that really do support municipalities, then you are creating new strategies that support people right there on the ground as it creates a different tax base and improving the tax base, which supports everybody.
Erin joins the program from Ketchikan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Erin.
Thanks, Steve. This is Sarah and Dave actually know me. I work for the Forest Service down in Ketchikan, and I'm so bummed I can't be up there for this.
Hey, somehow I knew. I thought you'd find a way to call in.
That's
it's impossible for me not to engage on this.
That's just fine. I'm all for it.
Aaron's a sharp one.
And Majora, I'm so bummed that I couldn't meet you, but I have read and heard all about you for years now, so I'm really thrilled that you're up in Alaska.
Oh, I'm sorry we won't meet.
Sarah. Hey, I wanted to follow up after Dennis's call. I believe I know what he's referring to, and I wanted to just close that loop, because the Forest Service is actually a pretty active partner.
Mm-hmm. Good.
If I'm correct, I think he's referring to the Shore Zone project, which may have started around Cook Inlet, but developed into a statewide effort to basically document and do some data analysis on the entire shoreline of Alaska, which is it's a huge effort, but it's an incredible resource, and it is, everything's online. All of the photos, they're high resolution photos, are all online, and then what they're doing is they're taking the photos and then they're analyzing it and classifying the biological and physiological information on the ground. So in terms of like a resource for monitoring, it's amazing, and considering how much of the state is dependent on our coastline, I think it's a really monumental task. And so there's a whole slew of partners. If you go to if you Google Shore Zone Alaska, the first couple of hits will take you there. NOAA is the lead on it, but you've got Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, the Nature Conservancy, the Wildlife Refuge System, the Park Service, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a whole slew of folks.
And Aaron, I believe I know they've done the entire shoreline, in Prince William Sound of the Chugach. They've done the Tongass as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the aim is the whole state.
Yeah, Aaron.
So it's a really cool project, and it is going to. I mean, one of the focus areas is this is going to be a vital resource as we continue down the road of looking at how climate change is impacting our communities and our natural communities and our human communities and so forth.
Yeah, well, when I think about the value that Matthew Sturm got out of just going to World War II era pictures of the tundra, and seeing that how many more shrubs there were there now and what that was doing to the albedo of the whole northern region of the state, I'm sure that there's just tons of GIS applications that we'll be seeing coming on in the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, Steve, and you're really hitting one thing, too, that photo documentation can tell so much of a story that we can't tell with just words, right? Mm. So.
Yeah. See, the secret, and Aaron, thanks a bunch. This is not the first time you've saved my bacon. And but the behind that is the leadership that it took to put that collaborative together and get it going. And so there's a story behind every one of these. We in Washington like to call them place-based collaboratives because we've never seen a syllable we didn't want to print. But there's got to be a shorter term. But it's basically the same kind of thing. What sparks getting together to solve a problem like that and providing it? And I think if you can replicate that, you can get that kind of innovation in a package. I think you can do this in a lot of different places.
Well, we got a lot of places where our nautical charts are all off, and it's all local knowledge. And people don't. I mean, you need to know. Okay, you line up between this and that, and then you steer and point right at that. You got to talk to somebody about that to get across the damn bar, And why don't we even start with Bristol Bay? It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about hometown security, among other things, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Well, I've just been informed that if you go to our website, you can get the link to the Shore Zone thing. And just like that.
Impressive.
The power of radio. it's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the classrooms for climate. I guess it's a symposium, we call it a symposium?
Yes.
Yeah, going on. That's got more syllables.
It goes back and forth between symposium and conference. People who have been in academia longer like symposium.
Yeah. Well, are you hoping that this is just the beginning of a more constructive partnership between the public landholder that you represent and the university?
Yeah, absolutely. We're hoping this is just a first step in launching a larger partnership with the university, not just in looking at where are our shared research needs and as they relate to climate, but also, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of student education and being able to create pathways to employment in the public lands and creating jobs. These are green jobs in our public land community, creating green jobs for Alaskan kids in school at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And being an ANSEP is a really great first step. So we already have a number of collaborations with the university, and how do we kind of begin to package that into one cohesive kind of
I think Sarah Borio of Chugach National Forest, I want to make you the kind of POC for people who call in. Often during Talk of Alaska, there's all these people that get themselves all worked up, and they have these great ideas and for partnerships for the Forest Service, and I think you ought to be the person to field those calls.
Just throw one more on my plate. Yep. I know somewhere Erin is laughing. She did.
I think we got Erin's phone number.
I know. We might have to call her back. I'll need her help on this one.
Okay, great. It's Sarah Borio at the Chugach National Forest Office of Public Affairs and Partnership. We also have Dave Cleaves of the, he's the National Climate Change Advisor for the Chief of the U.S. Forest Service in Washington, D.C. We're talking about this Classrooms for Climate thing, and we're kind of diverting over to agriculture. Somebody told me it was Agriculture Day, so it's only right that we're talking about agriculture. Well, Forest Service is in the agriculture department, is certainly certainly about agriculture. I heard that it was actually Forest Service that got you started down this long.
Yes, actually, it was. I owe huge forces of my career to Forest Service. No, really, seriously.
Just some little grant from the Forest Service.
Yeah,
here you are in the South Bronx. Right. Oh, I found my water. It's right here. This one little spot in between the warehouses.
We were fighting for more sustainable solid waste management plans around because our city and our state, and around the same time, I got this notice and kept being visited by this lovely young woman named Jenny Hoffner, who was working as part of a consortium with the Forest Service and National Park Service and a few other agencies. And they were giving these little seed grants to different groups to help restore the Bronx River, and it's significant because it's the only true freshwater river in all of New York City.
Yeah, I'm a watershed collaborator, as a matter of fact.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so, fortunately for me, around that same time, I got it. I didn't believe it, and I thought people were well-meaning, but clearly had no idea what my neighborhood looked like, because I knew we were a waterfront community, but there were lots of, waste facilities or distribution centers, whatever, on our waterfront.
Yeah.
My huge dog decided to take me jogging into what I thought was a dump, and it turned out that dump actually did, in fact, lead into the Bronx River. And that's when I realized that we, in fact, were a waterfront community, that we could, in fact, turn that into literally the beginning of our waterfront revitalization, which I then knew would work in other areas.
Was that your first TED Talk where you talked about that?
I did talk about that in my TED Talk, yeah.
And yeah, that was one of the first TED Talks.
Yeah. And since then, that was released online, actually. There were plenty. There were 15 years or so of TED Talks. But this one was one of the first released online. And it was, and now that park exists, and it's really beautiful. I just talked about it as it was being built.
Right.
But now it is absolutely gorgeous.
But there's also actual agricultural production.
Mm-hmm. Not at that park, but what we realized was that, and again, my work really is about how do you use environmental design and create accessible jobs at the same time. And if you look at America's food system, it's not really the most effective kind of thing. It uses a lot of fuel for transportation, in addition to pesticides and herbicides. It's literally made out of petroleum-based products, so you don't necessarily want to be eating that, but many of us do, and we know the impact that much of the unhealthy food that is produced that way, through our food system, doesn't necessarily, it's not all that healthy to people. So we realize that what would be another way to create jobs, in our cities and really augment the demand for local food, local agriculture that many municipalities and people in those places want, is we'd have to augment what traditional growers are doing, in their systems, and create greenhouse systems within cities, using hydroponic technology, and which in the same area you can grow up to 10 times as much food, using that kind of system. And if you bring all that together under one national brand, because Americans love their brands, if you do that, then people would be able to buy that, rather institutions through institutions and or retail establishments in metropolitan areas. So you're creating jobs in the inner city. You're creating a food system that is a local food system in any given area that's dependent on both rural and urban growers.
And this is up and going.
No. We're hopefully going to launch it in Chicago, but the goal is all over the place.
What we got here, of course, you got your fish when they come in, and you have some gathering that goes to marketing, and there's been some efforts to do something with the berry crops, but it haven't really gone too far so far because there's land ownership problems. We got tofu makers, we got sprouters, And we got tons of potatoes. We got lots and lots of potatoes and carrots.
This is in Alaska.
Here in Alaska. But, you know, I'm thinking in terms of the sort of micro model that you're looking at, you know, sprouters and going to the premium markets, you know, that want this, you can say it's a higher quality product. Well, best of luck on that. Let's go to Mike in Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey.
I just have a quick question for Majora, and it was a perfect segue she just had there.
Okay.
I was just thinking about rural Alaska. There's a lot of small villages and small towns across Alaska where a lot of the food is flown in or they're boated in. And just as you talked about, a lot of it isn't so healthy and a lot of it's processed,
A lot of it's soda pop, I'll tell you.
Any suggestions on how to really get a micro ag business going in some of these small communities? I think it could be really helpful for the employment and healthy eating habits and self-esteem and all sorts of things.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think the model that we're using, which is basically 1 to 3 acres of greenhouse under glass, but done in a way that it's actually very energy efficient to do so. The idea is that you can grow food, and it's literally meant to stay in your local area, you know, to support the institutions and the retail establishments, so the schools or the hospitals that are there or the restaurants or whatever, that's what it's meant to do. So again, it's all about making sure that you're circulating dollars that stay in your local economy. So the people that work, you know, in these greenhouse systems, you know, are the people that live in those communities, and the people that they're selling it to are also the institutions that are in those same regions. So, you know, this, you know, we are a nation that used to be, you know, a nation of producers. I mean, I think it really is in our DNA. We might have forgotten it, you know, over the past, you know, few decades when, you know, we lost a huge amount of our manufacturing base and realized that it was fun being a consumer and only that. But I think at some point, you know, we're going to come back to the fact that we can do this again and really create local economic development models that support our local everything we want. We don't have to move out of our neighborhoods to live in a better one. And I think we're starting to believe that again.
Mike, I think it's already starting in Bethel. I think once we have somebody with successful root cellaring, successful greenhousing, you realize once you get this ground warm, you can really do a lot with it. There's quality soil there. You got to have the right microorganisms. I think it's on its way. I want to thank you so much for your call from Homer. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. Sarah Boreal, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
And you're the person that I'll send people to. Dave Cleaves, best of luck.
Thanks, Steve.
Getting through to him in Washington.
Okay.
And Majora Carter, I think you're just going to knock him dead.
Aw, thank you. I want him to live, though. No dead people.
All right. Thank you. It's Talk of Alaska. I want to thank Josh Edge and Dave Waldron, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.